Our next guest, Sharon Moalis, who is a licensed clinical social worker at Yale New Haven Hospital with 40 years of Moalis. Okay, with 40 years of experience. Oh, Moalis. Shall I get it right? Eventually, I'll get it right. Sharon, I apologize. Yes, eventually, I'll get it right. I understand you have 40 years of experience in working with victims of domestic violence, and you are the lead social worker at Yale New Haven Hospital, currently in the ER, which I can't imagine what you see. It must be extraordinary. And I was reading in the Hartford, I was reading in the Hartford Current, just a general article. You know, there were two separate terrible tragedies that ended in women's deaths that were completely unexpected to their own communities and families, in which two women were killed in apparent murder suicides by their husbands. It's just unbelievable. And then there was another one. A woman who was kidnapped with her baby, and a third was forced out of her home with her baby as her partner shouted at her from a window, leading to a 10-hour police standoff. I mean, it just goes on and on and on. People dying from gunshot wounds, you know, strangulation. It just doesn't end. And domestic violence experts are saying that, you know, for me, Sharon, for me as a suburbanite for many years, and as somebody who lives in an illusion of safety, even though it's been burst occasionally, I can tell you that I know for certain from talking with various police departments that domestic violence is the number one crime that we see in suburban areas and maybe even in some urban areas.
Yes, I
don't even like the name. Can we call it family violence? Do we have to call it domestic? There's nothing domestic about it.
Yeah, well, actually, the appropriate name now is intimate partner violence, because, I mean, that cuts across all lines of communication. Mm. It's intimate. It happens in every community. There's no community exempt from it. And it doesn't matter about income, whether high or low. Women are running for their lives. Women are afraid. And it's a dirty secret. It's the hardest thing for a person to come to grips with, is that your partner is not only physically abusive to you, maybe verbally abusive to you, maybe sexually abusive to you. And sometimes people live fairy tale lives and they want to put on this front that everything is okay when they know behind closed doors it's not. And so what we're seeing is an uptick of women as they're coming into the emergency room, and they may come in with a medical complaint, and then with the safety net of the emergency room, then they may share, you know, they have bruises that cannot be explained, and they may say, sometimes my partner, he gets upset, he hits me, or I don't like the way he treats me, or I'm fearful for my life because the last time we were arguing, he threatened to kill me. I mean, these are very real concerns. The hardest part for a woman is to decide to leave.
I know. And then it's the most dangerous because, to be honest, you know, people can talk women into leaving the situations till they're blue in the face. But unless they have an escape plan, that woman could be killed for trying to leave.
That's right. And that's why we tell women quietly to make a plan and a backup plan, because once they acknowledge that they are leaving, that's when they're really at risk for being killed.
So they really have to make it. So Sharon Moalis, what I'm hearing from you, 203-333-9422, if you want to be part of this conversation. What I'm hearing from you is that women have got to escape from a domestic violence situation the way they would escape from a prison camp, in secret. In secret. They've got to dig tunnels and figure out how they're going to get out on the other side.
That's right. And then you have to have a place to go. And so I try to look at safety nets. I mean, there's a lot of numbers. There's a lot of programs out there. But I say to women, the number you want to remember is 911. That is the emergency number.
Okay.
Call 911 and say, help. I need help. And to escape, come into an emergency room because you can use a medical complaint to get yourself out of harm's way. Get into the emergency room, and we'll do our best to try to support you to the next step. to the next level.
Oh, that's good to know, Sharon. So in other words, if somebody is in a, if somebody listening to us right now is in a situation where you're afraid, you're going to say something like, I have a pain here or an injury mm-hmm. here. Or I can't walk. I need to go to the ER. I think I'm having a heart attack. Doesn't matter what it is. And then when you get there, you need to be alone with some treating somebody or other and say to them, I'm here because I'm afraid of my husband. Now, then what is the ER supposed to do when they hear about it? What are they supposed to do?
Well, the ER would immediately call social work. And the advantage that we have here at Yale is that we have the availability of social workers 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. So there's always a social worker on site. And then what we would do is take it to the next step. Where is she at? What are her resources? Is there family that she can go to? Is she interested in a referral for a shelter, a domestic violence shelter?
Are those secret?
Yes, of course. Of course they are. Mm-hmm. And we work hand in hand with all our community resources as collaborators for the safety needs of women. And that's an important issue for us. And then we have a wonderful medical team that they're very, very supportive when we say, you know, it's going to take us time to work with this particular woman to find a safety place for her to be at. And sometimes they come with their children. Mm-hmm. You always have to remember children are witnessing this.
I know.
And so it's not just a plan for herself. It may be a plan for her and her children. And then, as I said, then once we call those resources, then if they go into a shelter, that is all confidential. That is all confidential. So the shelter sites are confidential.
So we're talking with Sharon Moles, who is the lead social worker at Yale New Haven Hospital. We're talking about domestic violence. There's a hotline, but what Sharon is saying is the only hotline you really need to remember is 911. There's also a Spanish coalition in case Spanish is your first language or someone that you know Spanish is their first language. So don't worry about that as an impediment. And then there is the website itself, ctcadv.org. But the bottom line is Sharon is saying, look, if you're in trouble and you're afraid or you know somebody who is, show up at an ER. Figure out a way to be alone with some practitioner some way. And you can probably do that, right? I mean, Sharon, how would you how would you give an excuse to somebody that wanted to get rid of their shadow if their abuser was stalking them at the ER as well? What would you say to them?
Well, from a triage perspective, is that there's several things that you can do. You can let that triage nurse know, help.
Yeah, but what if you can't say, what if you can't say help because the guy is right at your elbow? What do you do about that?
So, you know what? This is being very innovative. If you have a pen with you, write it. So you're not even talking.
Uh-huh. Put it on the palm of your hand and make sure they see it.
Mm-hmm. That's right. So that clearly there's some innovative things that you want to let that person know who's assessing you that there's more to this story, that I need help. And then what that person will do, and we have a very convenient way of doing it, is that, oh I'm sorry, you have to sit here while we take our patient into another room for further medical evaluation. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then that gets that person out of harm, immediate harm's way. And then we can put her in the safety net of an emergency room. And we've done this. We've done this. And then we can tell the person, I'm sorry, right now you have to wait out here because we always need to talk with our patients and to evaluate them medically alone. So you need to sit, have a seat, and so on until we can figure out what her plan, what does she want from us, what does she need from us. And so this is important. So we work hand in hand. And, of course, we do get people who are very irate because they don't want to be separated. And then that's when we may have to involve our protective service people, our security team here, and say, I'm sorry, you have to because you can't come in.
Sharon Moles, will you stay on with us? You're listening to WICC. I want to continue this very important conversation. about ways in which people who are experiencing domestic violence can escape right in plain sight, literally escape in plain sight. Sharon, will you stay with us? I want to come right back.
Yes.
Thank you so much. Sharon Moles on the Lisa Wexler Show, 203-333-9422. We'll be right back.
Voted Westport Lifestyle Reader's Choice for Best Radio Show. The Lisa Wexler Show is back on WICC 600 AM and 107.3 FM.
On the air with us now is Sharon Moles, who is the lead social worker at Yale New Haven Hospital. And what we're talking about is something that in all these years of broadcasting, I didn't realize that there was an escape valve for victims of domestic violence, and that was simply showing up with a different excuse at your local ER and making sure that somebody there knows that you need help. Sharon, welcome back to the show.
Okay.
So, Sharon, I mean, how often does this really happen to you where you are doing a shift or you're on call and you hear that a woman has presented herself to the ER, sometimes with kids, and needs to not leave the ER to go home? She needs to immediately go elsewhere.
Oh, this happens almost on a weekly basis.
Really?
I mean, it's an incredible increase of women who are coming forward. And as I said, it's so hard for them to make that decision because economically, many times they may be in a controlling relationship where the man controls the finances. So it's not just the physical, it's just the financial as well. I'm giving up everything. I'm giving up my furniture. I'm giving up my livelihood just to get away from this abusive partner. So people do come in. They find their way in. Sometimes they're not ready. Sometimes they may come in and say, I want to know what my options are. And then that's when we counsel them and we talk with them about developing a safety net for themselves, so, you know, putting things aside for themselves, if they have friends or associates or coworkers that would allow them to do that, planning their escape. And then coming back to us when they're ready. So, as I said, it happens on a weekly basis that we have women that show up, and some are ready to leave, and some are still contemplating.
Do you try and talk women into leaving if you see, if you as a social worker recognize signs of abuse?
I don't try to talk them into it. I tell them the truth. It's not going to stop. I tell them the truth. It's only going to get worse. I tell them that there is no such good parent, a good father, if he's humiliating you, beating you, verbally abusing you in front of your children. He's not a good parent. I tell them the truth, and they know it already.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's you leave the door open, and you invite them to walk through the door. And as I said, I have seen women have come back and say, no, I'm ready, because you're right. It didn't stop. You know, it's like it's a cycle of violence. I beat you up, then I bring you flowers. You know, babe, if you were nicer, I wouldn't have to do this. Why do you keep making me do this to you? It's your behavior. It's your behavior. You're the cause of this. So they convince the woman that, you know, you need to change your behavior, and then I will treat you better. And then people have to come to grips with the reality. It's not about you. It's about him. He's beating you up because this is the way he interacts with you. And there's nothing that you did to deserve to be treated with such inhumane treatment. So I leave the door open, but I tell people the truth. It's not going to stop.
The battered ego, you know, I remember this one line in Pretty Woman which is a movie that I detest for a lot of reasons, even though it's superficially entertaining. I detest it because I've had people on my show say that they know that women have gone into sex work because they've seen the movie and they believe this fairy tale Cinderella romance, which makes me vomit. But there's one really good line in the movie where Julia Roberts says the bad stuff is so much easier to believe. And I think about that line a lot because I think it's really true. We as human beings, maybe even uniquely women, but maybe also men, whenever we hear something negative about ourselves, that sticks. And we tend to dismiss compliments and we tend to dismiss niceties that people say to us as, oh, you're just saying that. But the bad stuff we never forget. And
that's
so
right.
And so for women that are victims of this campaign to smash their ego into bits, it's very hard to reconstruct their self-esteem enough to say, I'm going to get out of here. In other words, because
they
feel so low.
That's right. That's right. And women have shared that, you know, I have to be better because he gets upset if I'm talking on the phone and I'm trying to cook dinner and he gets upset. Didn't I tell you about talking on the phone? Or they begin to isolate that woman from her friends, isolate her from her family. You know, I am all that you have. And so it's purposeful. It's purposeful. So the verbal abuse is purposeful, because if I can take you down a peg or two and make you feel I am the best thing you got going on, then you're going to be totally relying on me because I'm all that you got. So now I can treat you any which way because I can control you. I can control all of your behaviors, your actions, your interactions, and all of the above. So sometimes when women come, they don't have any sense of self. Mm-hmm. Their self-esteem is in the toilet because that's what they had to believe about themselves in order to stay in this unhealthy relationship. So it takes a lot. It takes a team. It takes a village. It takes a lot of counseling for a person to separate themselves and begin to believe, I am deserving. I don't need to be treated with such bad behaviors. I want my children to have a better opportunity. I don't want my daughters to grow up and believing that this is how you enter a relationship. This is how you have a relationship. I don't want my sons to grow up and think this is how you need to treat women.
Yeah,
so
you're
it
right.
becomes very difficult.
Yeah. We're talking with Sharon Moles, who is a licensed clinical social worker. She's the lead social worker at Yale New Haven Hospital with a specialty of many, many decades in domestic violence. Sharon, at 203-333-9422 is our number. Sharon, how many beds do we have for women like this? Do you ever find that you need to turn women away? Or will Connecticut always find a bed for somebody looking to escape?
Well, that's a shelter issue. And what we would do is work with our domestic violence shelter services, the umbrella. We work with them hand in hand. The Hope Center, as I said, it takes a village. And we have had some success in many times in working with the shelters. If the shelter did not have a bed readily available, sometimes they have put women in hotels from a safety issue to try to get them out of harm's way.
Okay. So we won't turn a woman away. Women shouldn't be afraid that if they ask for help that there will not be a helping hand. There will be a helping hand. That's what I wanted to know. And are you seeing, Sharon Moles, are you seeing more women come forward? In your gut feel, are there more incidents of domestic violence, or is there just more, or are there just more women coming forward? I mean, what's your sort of sense of the zeitgeist in terms of relationships?
Well, I think that there's been an increase. I think that women are seeing more exposures. I mean, like you just said so candidly, I mean, women are dying. Okay,
yeah, they are.
So
they
it's
are.
On the news.
They are.
You know, it's this come out of the box. It's on TV that someone has been murdered at the hands of their partner. So I think women are beginning to see all of the signs are all around them. I think that we need to do more community announcements if you're feeling unsafe. There is a way out. I think that we need to continue that pace. But women are coming forward.
Well, I'm thankful about that. And, you know, with a couple of minutes we have left, Sharon, you're a social worker. What are some of the warning signs in a dating relationship that would lead you to have the hackles on the back of your neck go up and say, this is a red flag, get out of this relationship?
The unhealthiness. You know, babe, I like you, but you know, you're kind of fat. You know, you should do better. You know, you might need to work out a little bit better. Babe, you know, you could cook my food like this. Babe, I really don't like your friends, or on second thought, I don't like your family either. You know, I don't like to be around them. You do so much better when they're not here. They're not good for you. So people begin to take you, number one, apart, take your self-esteem apart. And we see a lot of adolescents who are going through that in their relationships.
Yes.
They begin to isolate you from family and friends so you could totally rely on them. Those are the really key warning signs that help that person begin to realize I might not be in a healthy relationship.
And then you got to get out before it's too late.
Yes. That's right. That's
gotta
right.
Got to get out. You know, as parents, this is something that we could be monitoring too.
Yes. And I think that even sometimes with kids in high school, you know, because our self-esteem, particularly for girls, we work at it constantly.
Yes.
And being in an unhealthy relationship, you know, if that person is so critical of you, why are they with you?
Yeah, exactly.
What do they see good about you? Do you know, you might want to look at this. Yeah. This is not good.
Yeah. I mean, if you know, my kids, neither one of them dated in high school. They both started dating later. And I never had this with my daughter. She just, her first boyfriend ended up being her husband. He's a great guy. No complaints, period. And we adore him. My son had his heart broken a couple of times, but not abusively so. But I think if I was ever a parent, Sharon, and I saw my kid, I don't care how old they were, in that kind of a relationship, I would be a warrior. I would risk my relationship with them in order to have them stop their relationship with someone else. And I know a lot of parents are afraid to do that, but I would not be afraid.
Yes, because you know, this is before the hidden starts.
Correct.
It's the psychological
abuse.
It's
the psychological. Sharon Moles, thank you so much for joining us. 911 is the number you want if you're a victim of domestic violence, and stop by an ER and get some help. We have two people that I now want to have listen to each other. We have Judy from Fairfield, who was calling as a caller with respect to this ongoing conversation about the merger of M&T and People's Bank. And State Senator Ryan Fazio, representing the 36th, who's running for re-election as the incumbent Republican in a district that encompasses Greenwich, but also part of Stamford and New Canaan. Ryan, I am having you listen to Judy because this merger is causing a lot of problems for people in your district and elsewhere. So if you don't mind, before you and I chat, can we listen to Judy and hear what she wants to say?
Yes, I'd love to.
Thank you. Judy from Fairfield, go ahead, please. You're on the air.
Well, hello. On Tuesday, I waited on the telephone for someone to answer my questions for an hour, and then I had to give it up. And then the same thing happened on Wednesday, but I got a live person, and her name was Yvette. And so at this point, I was so frustrated, I just said, "Hi, Yvette, why don't you ask me a bunch of questions, because I don't know what I'm doing. And maybe we could resolve my problem." We both laughed. She got me through a remote situation, and my problem was solved immediately. So that
Good.
Might be the way to go. Go with a sense of humor, because they're under a tremendous amount of burden. So,
all right. Thank you, Judy.
That's my advice to anybody who has a problem.
Thank you, Judy. Thank you. Ryan, just so you know. Thank you, Ryan.
Just
thank you, Judy. Ryan, we had a caller just a few minutes ago, a gal named Jen, who can't find her online records. And that's because, you know, in this merger, M&T has basically erased, I don't know if you're a People's Bank customer, I am for 32 years, all of our online transactions are gone. Now, they had told us this, if you were paying attention to the fine print, before the merger. And I had, in fact, warned our listeners, I had warned myself. But in the same breath that they told us this, Ryan, they were telling us that our records would be available if we walked into a branch and needed them printed out. We just wouldn't be able to see them online. Well, it turns out Jen's been to a few branches. She can't get her records at all, and she can't close on her house because she needs these records in order to have the ultimate qualifying for her new mortgage to buy her house, and she's freaked out.
Yeah.
She's one of many, many stories. I understand the Attorney General is opening an investigation into this. But you're a state senator. Do you have anything to say to us about, I don't know, anything that you think you should be doing on a policy level to help people out with this merger?
Well, first of all, I'm going to have to learn more and make sure all of our ducks are in a row from a statutory standpoint as a state. If there should be laws on the books as is that would preempt this sort of thing, and the attorney general is right to open an investigation. If there are not sufficient laws on the books in order to protect people's records, then the state government, the state legislature needs to act to change that. But this is pretty much the first time I am hearing of it. So I will absolutely have to work on it and have my staff work on it to get a better read of the land so that we understand whether this is an enforcement problem or a policy problem.
Okay. Okay. So, Senator Fazio, hello. Welcome to the show. It's been a while. Let me just go into a couple of things. We had a chance to chat with Trevor Crow, who is your opponent. She's the Democrat for this seat. And you won in a special election last November. Is that right? Correct me if I'm wrong.
In last August, yes.
Last August. Okay. Last August. Okay. So, Ryan, one of the things that Ms. Crow says that she's very at odds with you about is your vote no to the Reproductive Freedom Act that was passed in May on allowing Connecticut to basically enshrine in statute a lot of things that had been protected via Roe v. Wade in anticipation of it being overturned, and also to allow Connecticut medical professionals to operate on whoever it, or to provide medical services and abortion services for whoever comes into the state, regardless of where they came into, without being worried that they're going to be guilty of breaking a law. So why did you vote against the bill? Can you explain your position, please?
Well, I'm glad you have me on because Ms. Crow is mischaracterizing the law totally. First of all, abortion is legal under Connecticut state law, and I think it should stay legal. Most Democrats and Republicans in Connecticut think it should stay legal. So there's a lot of clarity in that regard, and I want to start by saying that. 5414 was a very narrow law passed in order to change regulations surrounding surgical abortions, and what it did is it lowered the standards for care for surgical abortions, which were traditionally conducted by physicians, but now can be conducted by any number of health professionals, but not just physicians. And there were five different medical associations that testified against the bill, saying that it posed risks and it significantly lowered the health and safety standards, and that they were concerned and opposed the passage of the bill for that reason. The Constitution, Connecticut state law, already preempts any other state from, you know, from going after people here in Connecticut for following Connecticut state law. So if that was just what the bill was about, then there would have been a lot more people voting for it. But this bill was really a political attempt to try to create an election issue in Connecticut where there isn't much difference between Democrats and Republicans on an issue. In order to find kind of a wedge in Connecticut. Governing shouldn't be about creating wedges and creating politics. It should be about good policy and solving people's problems. And that's why 17 Democrats joined Republicans. 17 of my Democratic colleagues joined Republicans voting against this bill. That is a lot more than Democrats than ever defect to vote against a Democratic bill in the state legislature. So it shows that it wasn't really good faith. But again, abortion is legal under Connecticut state law. I think it should stay legal. And almost every Republican leader in the state also thinks it should stay legal.
So, I mean, when you were voting on the bill, we're chatting with State Senator Ryan Fazio. Did you really think that Roe v. Wade was going to be overturned? I mean, in other words, do you think the overturning of Roe v. Wade as a fact, as an actual fact versus a speculation, would change your mind now in retrospect, or would you still vote against the bill?
Well, this doesn't change the legality of abortion in Connecticut at all. All it does is changes some of the health and safety regulations regarding surgical abortion. So later on in the gestation period, but it does not alter the legality of abortion at all in Connecticut, which is legal. It's going to stay legal, and no one's going to change it. And this, so this, you know, Roe v. Wade, one way or the other, doesn't really affect the lay of the land in Connecticut. And this, I mean, that's a good question, because this basically is totally irrelevant from that fact. But it is kind of the election issue that Democrats, the leadership, was trying to create. But again, 17 of my Democratic colleagues voted against it because they agreed it was bad policy. And that rarely happens, that you have that many defections in Hartford.
I see. We're chatting with State Senator Ryan Fazio. Could you tell us, State Senator, what are your thoughts? Because this is your area, your community in Greenwich. What are your thoughts about the James O'Keefe Veritas situation, this group called Greenwich Patriots, who is based in Greenwich? They send me emails almost every day about their agenda. And, you know, are you somebody who is in agreement with a lot of the policy goals of Greenwich Patriots, which have to do with assuming that there is a lot of liberal orthodoxy coming into public schools that they want to ferret out? They are very suspicious, Greenwich Patriots is, of vaccinations, particularly COVID vaccinations. Tell me where you stand with respect to these hot button issues.
So I don't know, you know, what exactly their stances are or whatever. All I could tell you is, you know, as you're asking, I'll just tell you my stances on any number of issues. The video of the assistant principal in Coscom School, which is about half a mile from my house, was extremely disturbing and shocking. And it was disturbing and shocking to parents who are Democrats, parents who are Republicans, parents who are unaffiliated in our area and beyond. And I had hundreds of messages expressing that fact. Mm. The idea that our school should be discriminating and hiring against Catholics or older people or conservatives is absolutely illegal and immoral. The idea that the school should be used in order to politically indoctrinate kids, which is exactly what this assistant principal expressed on the 12-minute long video, is totally unacceptable. So I think that there is significant agreement. You know, the vast majority of people in our district agree that what happened on what was expressed on that 12-minute video is totally unacceptable. There should, Fred Camillo, our first selectman, is correct that there should be a fully independent investigation, independent of the school district, rather, so that we understand what's going on and that there could be the correct punishment for anyone who committed wrongdoing. And then I've also said the state government needs to lead in order to ensure transparency in our schools and to ensure that there is as much trust as possible in our schools. We love our schools. We love our teachers. We love our kids. And we want to support all of them. And the type of things that were expressed on that video full-throatedly cannot be allowed to persist. So that's where I stand on that issue. So going back to your other question, was COVID vaccines?
Yeah.
So yeah. I've always said that I think the COVID vaccines have been demonstrated to be very effective at reducing severe infection and the risks of severe infection, especially for older people and people with underlying conditions. I think people should be able to freely choose whether to take the vaccines or not. I don't think they should be forced by the government. But I've always said that I think all the evidence suggests that, especially for older people and for sicker people, that there are significant benefits of reducing the risk of severe infection for COVID vaccines. And I've said that, you know, for a year or 2 years now.
We're chatting with State Senator Ryan Fazio, 203-333-9422, if you want to be part of the conversation. You know, one of the big hot button issues in almost every community, particularly in suburban areas, has to do with zoning and 830G. I saw today, very interesting, in New Canaan, I don't know if you saw this, Ryan, that they are proposing to consider a big part of downtown as a historic district in order to explore whether or not that can alleviate some of the 830G pressures. And that might be something interesting for them and other towns to explore if that's something that, you know, as a matter of policy, people support. I was wondering, you represent part of New Canaan as well as part of Stamford and all of Greenwich. You know, Greenwich has been responding to an onslaught of 830G kinds of issues. So how do you vote in Hartford when it comes to these zoning issues?
I think I'm a leading voice for local control in our state and our state legislature. I ran on supporting more local control. I won, and I've spent the last year plus in the legislature pushing legislation that I've actually authored and introduced in order to increase local control, because I trust our local leadership and local governments more than our state bureaucracy and state politicians in order to advance the interests of our town. You know, ensure that we have the proper planning and zoning, ensure that we advance affordable housing goals in a sustainable way, and so on and so forth. So I actually submitted one of the major bills this term in order to significantly change 830G and ensure we have more local input. So I've been very outspoken, very clear, and tried to prioritize reform on this issue. The state government has failed on issue after issue, and the idea that they should be empowered to control the local goings-on in our towns rather than the local leadership, the local planning and zoning, the local officials, I think runs counter to what the vast majority of people in our three towns and other towns across the state understand. The record of this law, the 830G law, which, you know, for your listeners who don't know, basically allows developers to go totally around all planning and zoning rules in 130 some towns out of 169 towns and cities in the state. It isn't successful. It hasn't succeeded in alleviating poverty and creating upward mobility in the state in the 30 years that it's been on the books. So now it's time for change. You have 30 years to achieve goals that you set out for yourself and you totally fail to do it, there needs to be change. I think we can all agree on that.
Well, the other thing is, this is my own view, but it assumes that multifamily dense housing is what poor people want. I wouldn't make that assumption, because I think that a lot of poor people would rather have a stake in their own home versus continuing to rent personally. And also, multifamily housing doesn't lend itself, as a matter of living, generally speaking, with some exceptions, to neighborhoods and communities and feeling of having an investment and a sense in your own community. But also, we know that it failed in the cities. If we look at our cities, it's our cities that need attention, Ryan. Our cities deserve attention. They need attention. They need to be a beacon for my kids to want to live there. And nobody talks about that. When my kids think about living in the city, they think of only Manhattan. They don't say to me, you know what? I'd like to go to New Haven. It's a happening place. They should, but they don't.
Yeah, and that's part of the narrative. And I hear a lot of residents of cities who agree with us that 830G has failed say, this sounds like you're abandoning the city because you want to turn Darien into New Haven rather than make New Haven as amazing a place as it used to be, as desirable place as it used to be. And it's also not going to help any of the cities attract people and improve their neighborhoods when you have crime skyrocketing, as you have had for the past 2 years, since we had a police reform bill passed along party lines in the summer of 2020. And we've seen in places like New Haven, homicides double, more than double in the past two or three years. So we need a diversity in this state. Diversity is part of our strength among our 169 different towns and cities. Even within our towns and cities, there's strength and diversity, because I represent Stamford, and North Stamford is totally different than the south end of Stamford. We have all these cool different neighborhoods, but what 830G says is one size fits all. If one size fits all doesn't even fit within our towns and cities themselves, to say nothing of between our 169 different towns or cities. Again, local democracy, local control is one of the things that has made our state wonderful over many, many years. We shouldn't abandon that, but that's exactly what the state leadership wants to do. They want to actually double the 830G requirements under one of the bills that's currently in front of the legislature. So this is not just a question of the status quo versus making things better. This is actually a question of whether we're going to make things a lot worse or better.
Ryan Fazio, thank you very much for joining us. Good luck in November. You're running as the incumbent Republican for the 36th state Senate seat encompassing Greenwich and part of New Canaan as well as Stamford. Thanks for joining us on the show today. Joining us now is an extremely talented author. Her name is Jennifer Ziegler, and she writes children's and young adult books. And she's very, very well known in the industry. But there was just this unbelievable write-up of called Voice in the Wilderness. No, not that one. The Language of Love, a precious logophile learns that the spaces between words are as important as the words themselves. Lynn Truss wrote in a beautiful, beautiful book review of our guest, Jennifer Ziegler. The book is Wurzer, which was described by others as nothing less than a work of genius. And you don't hear that too often when we talk about books, and particularly children's books that can have such an impact on kids as they're growing up, on their psyche, on their value systems. Jennifer Ziegler, welcome to the Lisa Wexler Show today. Hello. Thank you for joining us. Hi.
Pleasure.
Hi. And thanks for holding, by the way. We were running a little late. That's what, you know what? Talk radio does that. I get a caller. We go. I'm sorry about that.
Writing does that, too. So yeah. I understand.
I know writing does. So I want to ask you, Jennifer Ziegler, who is Wurzer? Who is Wurzer?
Wurzer is a boy. He's a 12-year-old boy who has been through a lot. And I feel like many people know a Wurzer in their life. He is someone who sort of owns his smarts, which I love about him. He's very smart. He's not going to make any apologies about it. And he's very particular about words. He loves words. This is his passion. This is how he sees the world. And this is how he has bonded with his mother, who has been basically the only real figure in his life. She's a single mom. He doesn't have many friends. So he and I share that love of words. But the people around him, the students his own age, don't really get that.
Mm. Yeah, I'm sure. He has to wait at least until high school. Then he'll find some camaraderie with other wordsmiths. And so what has happened to Wurzer in the opening pages of the book?
Well, I mentioned his mother. His father died when he was very young. And Wurzer is the product of two university professors. So, you know, by the time he starts kindergarten, he's really unaccustomed to speaking to anyone under the age of 40. he's not adequately socialized. And so it was his mother and him for so long. And by the beginning of the book, when he is starting seventh grade, his mother had recently suffered a debilitating stroke, which has robbed her of her words, in effect. She has, which is how they bonded. She's working on regaining her speech, but she can only do single syllables at this point. So his world has just been completely upended at the beginning.
And so the irony or the sadness of all of this is that his mother, who was a wordsmith herself, can only say things like beh, gyeh.
Yep.
And so part of the book is her struggle to regain her speech, even as the world around Wurzer is complaining and disappointed that he's not fully engaged enough, right? He's sitting in front of the principal's office. He's not happy. But he makes some friends along the way, right? He makes some unexpected friends.
He does. And community is so important. And this is what, in effect, really saves him, I think. I think we all need to find people who see us as we are and accept us as we are. And he does, through a lot of twists and turns, he finds those people. But to your point of before the stroke, which was a terrible thing, but before the stroke, he was really not engaged in life.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
by the end of the book, I believe he is definitely more engaged.
We're chatting with Jennifer Siegler. The book is Werzer, and it's gotten extraordinary accolades. When you write a book, Jennifer, and is this, by the way, is this a young adult book or a children's book? What is this? What category would you call this book?
It's the industry categorizes it as a middle grade book.
Okay.
Which is not necessarily middle school. It is basically upper elementary on up is what
right.
it is. So,
if you're even in third grade and you're a good reader and you're ahead of yourself, you could read this book. You could understand the vocabulary and you could understand what you're getting at in the book, right?
I think so. I think as a precocious third grader would really be into this.
I do too, because I'm actually going to give it to a precocious third grader that I'm thinking about right
now. Oh, great.
Yes, for sure. And I definitely will. And how do you, this has always been fascinating to me, Jennifer, how do you access your middle self, your middle grade self in writing the book? How do you do that? Where do you go back to?
I think I never fully left that
okay.
age, to be honest. I think I grew up wanting to be Judy Blum. So I've always adored children's books. And children's books, I think right now there is just a golden age of children's literature happening. There are so many great books. So I continued, even when I was a middle school teacher, I was very much engaged in the literature and getting students excited about the books. I remember even when I had two kids, and I'd be pushing them in the cart around the grocery store, and I would look around and I'd think, all these other people are real grown-ups.
Mm.
And I'm not. And when is
funny.
People going to figure that out? And I'm going to get in trouble. Like, they are all thinking about grown-up things like fertilizing their lawn and I'm not. So I think it's a little bit of a mindset, which is that some people might call it immaturity, but I like to think of it as a sort of open, curious, mindset. I stay sort of in a state of wonder about the world.
Yeah, that's what Abraham Heschel said, the great Jewish philosopher, that's how you have to enjoy life, by being in a state of wonder.
I think it has served me well in the sense that I am continually delighted and surprised.
We're chatting with Jennifer
Siegler.
The book is Werzer, Werzer. It's getting extraordinary reviews. I have it. It's a beautiful book. I personally love this genre too. I'm not sure I graduated from it myself. And I'm thinking, as you mentioned, Judy Blume, that when I was, I'm gathering I'm older than you, just to guess. And because when I was 12, Are You There, God, It's Me, Margaret came out, more or less. I have to look at the publication date, but in my mind's eye, I think I was in fifth grade or sixth grade. And when Are You There, God, It's Me, Margaret came out, I don't know if you remember this, Jennifer, but it had a menstruation scene. And I want to tell you that blew everybody's mind at the time. That just shows how naive the world was at that time. And I remember my teacher, Mrs. Pepper, so I think it must have been sixth grade, gathering everybody around her to read this book to us, Are You There, God, It's Me, Margaret. And she was so intent on getting our reaction. And I remember that if we weren't in love with the book, and I was not in love with the book, that I was a contrary person, even then, not a surprise. And I remember that she was very disappointed in me because I didn't understand or fully really appreciate the genius of Are You There, God, It's Me, Margaret. Just letting you know. That's the truth. But I remember it was like a seismic, it was an earthquake. Are You There, God, It's Me, Margaret. At least in my elementary school.
I believe it.
It was a big deal, right? It's a big deal.
By the time I read it, I remember being confused about some of the particulars of the menstruation scene, like the belt.
Right, the belt. That was my era. Thank you very much, Jennifer. Actually, it was my mother's era. I was making my way to Stay Free Maxi Pads at that time, but there was still a belt. When my mother first taught me about menstruation, she showed me the belt. It's true. True. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. And I remember thinking, what is this contraption with these steel metal pieces on the front and back? Oh, Jennifer, just be happy you never had to learn from it. It was really something.
Happy. But that voice in the book, the voice, I think, is what I connected to.
Yes.
I think that she did really capture the voice of people that age. And that's what I wanted to do, is I wanted to be able to speak that frankly and that real, in such a real way to other people. Because in a way, it's like these books were extra friendships for me growing up.
I totally get
that.
And
I wanted to continue those connections.
Oh, I totally get that. The books on my shelves, I always refer to them as my friends. And when I move, I have to take them with me. You know, it's very interesting. We're chatting with Jennifer Ziegler. The book is Werzer, and it's a book described as a work of genius for middle graders, W-O-R-S-E-R. It's a beautiful book, beautifully written, with a lot of beautiful sensibilities to it and a lot to it. And I recommend
it to you. Thank
you. Yeah, no, it's a wonderful book. But, it, you know, in terms of home and decor nowadays, Jennifer, have you noticed how many houses don't have any bookshelves at all in them anymore? It's like passé. Have you noticed that?
I cannot understand that. And I was recently moving into a house, and I remember getting online to look for, you know, certain things we needed. And I saw this place that was selling books, and I thought, well, this is a home decor place. Why are they selling books? But they were just selling it by color scheme as decoration, not to read.
Right.
And that just blew my mind. And I do not understand people who don't have books around. I mean, I do understand sometimes people would prefer to read from a tablet. I'm not that way. Plus, I still, like I said, like you were saying, these books that I have read time and again are my friends. And even though I've already read them, they will always be with me.
They will always be with me, too. Jennifer Ziegler, what a pleasure to have you on today. Thank you for your writing. And we will
Thank
be following
you.
Your career with interest and with excitement. The book is Werzer, W-O-R-S-E-R. If you have a young adult in your life, you can buy this book for them and give them a present of a new friend. Thank you very much, Jennifer.
Thank you, Lisa. It was such a pleasure.
Me too.